Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Gerard Cassidy with us with RBC Capital Markets. Gerard, I've got a fiction five-year dividend growth coming off the trauma of 14%. Forget about that statistic. What's the model dividend growth that JP Morgan can deliver?
I think, Tom, when you take a look at the excess capital that these banks have, including JP Morgan Chase, and their core revenue and earnings growth, that dividend growth should be considered into the high single digits. I think that's reasonable, anywhere from 6 to 9%. These are not double digit, dividend growers. Now, there are periods like the one we just came out of where some banks increase dividends by double digit rates. But you must remember last year, dividends were frozen because of the pandemic. And there was a catch up, I think, in the recent announcement about dividend increases.
So when you overlay share buyback on that, are you starting January 1st with a JP Morgan cash on cash return above 8%? Dare I get out to 11% in a double digit share buyback dividend combination?
I think, Tom, you can see that the combination of the share repurchases and the dividends could easily exceed earnings, not just for JP Morgan, but for the industry as they, again, have this excess capital. So that would suggest, yes, we could see those types of numbers that you mentioned from JP Morgan as well as some of the other banks in the large bank universe.
There is a high bar, and they met that high bar in almost everything, with the exception being fixed income, commodities, and currencies trading. And yet the shares are lower in pre-market trading. What's your response to that, especially given that the only other disappointment that I'm seeing right now is net interest income?
It's going to be interesting because the total revenue number, as you guys have identified, was a little better than expected, and that's important. The other factor, though, is the supplementary leverage ratio fell to 5.4% from the prior quarter's 5.6. Now, by regulation, they cannot breach 5%. Internally, they have a 5.25% internal model that says they can't go below that. So the deposit growth you saw, once again, very significant deposit growth because of the monetary policy this country is pursuing with quantitative easing, and it's forcing these wholesale banks' balance sheets to basically bust at the seams. So I think maybe there's a little concern here that this leverage ratio is getting perilously close to their required minimum that they have set, which is 5.25%.
I know on mornings like this, we've got to ask the question, Lisa, but we are down 1.27% after a 4-5% move.
Look,
going
okay
into the numbers themselves. Got to frame this appropriately.
I understand that. Still, when you see beats pretty much across
the
board and such huge numbers, it is interesting that the knee-jerk response is, meh, that's all you got for me. And you have to wonder what people are looking at to see that, especially given the fact that there have been losses in some of the big banks over the past few weeks.
Well, Jared, just a final question. JP Morgan out the gate first. Now we're going to have the compare and contrast in the next couple of days. What are you looking for based on what you've seen already this morning?
I think what we're going to see, John, is that their FICC number was slightly below expectations, but it was still a very good number. So I think we have to keep an eye on the other banks' big FICC trading. But equity trading, as you pointed out, John, was better than expected. So I think from Goldman and Morgan Stanley, Citi, Bank America, we should expect equity trading numbers maybe to come in better. And lastly, the investment banking number, as you identified, was also better than expected. So I think the others are going to have similar numbers. And as I think Lisa pointed out, they are taking market share from their European competitors, and I think that was showing up again in the numbers we've seen so far this morning.
JP Morgan setting the bar for Goldman Sachs. We'll hear from them in around about 30 minutes' time. Gerard, appreciate your time today. This was special. It's nice to work through the numbers in real time with you. Gerard Cassidy there of RBC Capital Markets.
The economy is much more open than it was. Why is there such a rapid increase, and why are not people investing that elsewhere?
Let's ask that question to Anastasia Amoroso in a new seat at iCapital Network. The chief investment strategist joins us right now. Anastasia, good to catch up. Let's go there to Lisa's point. We were all projecting this big boom in growth this year, and that's largely developed through the first half. But what the consumers do with their cash has been slightly confusing. What's your read on things?
Yeah, I think the consumers have been venturing out into the real economy and they have been gradually putting that cash to work. I mean, I definitely think we see that in some of the reopening categories. For example, we see hotels that are pretty much back. We see restaurants. We see the travel services that are pretty much back. The consumers have also been switching from the durable goods to the services. And so that's what we're seeing now. But to Lisa's point, as you come back to the banking sector, I think some of the strength in the consumer that we're seeing and the credit card spending data, that's going to start to shift to the business sector. Part of the really weak spot in loan growth for the banks is actually the commercial and industrial loan growth. It has just not been there. But as the economy comes back online, as the CEOs, CFOs are increasingly comfortable with where things are, they're going to start to boost their CapEx plans, and that's going to need to require some loans and financing. So I think that's what we're likely to see for the banking sector over the next few quarters. I think JP Morgan is a sign of kind of things to come for the banking sector broadly. This is a solid result, but nobody is surprised. Everybody's already expecting 119% increase in this quarter's earnings year over year. So nobody's surprised. I still think, though, there's more catalysts to come for the banking sector.
Anastasia, a little bit off your remit at iCapital, but you've got fabulous experience, maybe like no one I know on the street, of moving from stodgy old bank to massive fintech advance like at iCapital. Do these big banks just have the high ground because they're so large and they're so technologically advantaged over all the other banks?
Well, so given the balance sheets and given the tech budgets for some of these banks, absolutely, they do have the advantage in putting that money to work and accelerating the innovation. So the question is, how much is the pace of this innovation accelerates, and are they nimble enough? Are they quick enough? So while I like the banking sector, the reason why fintechs are so attractive to us is because the big banks are not seeing loan growth. The smaller banks are seeing rapid market share acquisition. And, you know, you look at neobanking, for example, digital banks with no physical branches, the revenues of that sector today, probably $20 billion. In 5 years' time, that $20 billion goes most likely to $400 billion. Wow. So this is a significant growth. And I think the fintechs can definitely capture that opportunity set in a more pure way than a traditional bank sector can.
Anastasia, are there any real data points within these earnings that matter right now, given the fact that so much of people's view on banks really just hinges on what will happen later on, perhaps Q4?
Yeah, I would say there's two things to note about bank results today. First of all, where's the strength? Where's the bright spot in these results? It's actually investment banking advisory fees, advisory revenues. If you look at the strength in the equity capital markets, it's just stunning. For example, M&A had a banner quarter. The volumes are up about over 200%. IPOs have had a banner quarter and a banner year. They're up close to 200% in terms of volumes. So the investment banks are absolutely reaping the benefits. I think that's going to continue for some time, for a number of quarters, because if you think about the preconditions that have been put in place to support this market, you had zero rates, which lured investors into areas of higher growth and innovation economy. That's not going to change. Look at the fund flows. They're going into thematic funds, thematic ETFs, anything from robotics to space tourism to gene therapy. That's not going to change. So as a result, the public markets are offering premium valuations for some of these high-tech, high-growth stocks. And who's reaping the benefits of those higher valuations are private companies. They're tapping this IPO window. They're going public. And as a result, they're probably getting a valuation that's 3.5 times more than their last private round after the first day of trading. So the private equity investors are reaping the benefits, but also the banks, of course, are reaping the benefit through those advisory revenues. So I think that's going to be an area of strength for some time to come. Now, Lisa, the other point of this is a lot of optionality. As you say, we don't know what's going to happen in the future, but we can tell what's priced in, and we can guess where that may go. Loan growth is flat today. That's likely to inflect higher. Interest rates are zero today. The markets are pricing in a rate hike and a half through 2023. In 2023, what if we get there a little faster? What if we increase it a little bit more? That's optionality that's embedded in the banking sector right now. And then there's capital returns. There's excess capital that these banks have to return.
Yep.
So share repurchases, dividends, all of that is very favorable for the sector.
Anastasia, always good to catch up. Thank you. Busy morning for us, for you too. Anastasia Amoroso there of iCapital Network, the chief investment strategist.
Stephen Biggar joins us now with Argus, Director of Financial Institutions Research. Stephen, let me ask you the question, as Shanali Basak was adamant not to answer it here. How do these book value dynamics move? Does the giant and wonderful J.P. Morgan come in relative to the other banks? Do they advance their book value ratio versus J.P. Morgan?
I think they do. I mean, this is an environment where, The banks that have the best opportunity for longer term growth, more diversification, steadier earning stream, I think are the ones that get will continue to get the premium in terms of price to book. So, JPM is a company that's extraordinarily well diversified. They do benefit when capital markets are strong, as mm-hmm. they are currently, and frankly, if they have been the last four quarters. But of course, it's been Goldman Sachs's cup of tea in terms of the last four quarters. So we've had great M&A, we've had solid investment banking, trading results. Of course, they're starting to mm-hmm. Pull back a little bit from call just unsustainably high levels over the past few quarters.
Do they amend, or do they have a plan to diminish the sterling balance sheet ratios? Or do they just let it ride out? Do they manage them lower or not?
Well, I think they've tried, of course. And if you're talking about in terms of more sustainable capital returns, I think they'd very much like to do that. But still a precarious time for the economy. I think they'll probably keep those a bit longer. They do have much more flexibility now in terms of capital returns than they did prior. The Fed has been less of a babysitter in terms of the actual dividend and shareholder share buybacks. So, they've got that flexibility now to sort of give and take between the two. I think that gives them a lot more flexibility. And I think they're, riding out this economic recovery and seeing what they can do, sustainably for the long term.
Tom, you asked the question, so let's just look at the performance so far year to date. There's 20 percentage points of outperformance on Goldman versus J.P. Morgan so far year to date. We're at 44% on Goldman. Tom, J.P. Morgan are by 24%. Yeah. Look, J.P. Morgan's had a great year so far. It's just Goldman Sachs has had a fantastic year so far.
Well, there's just two different platforms. John, Jan Hatzi is coming out with GDP estimates within the report, I believe. And what's important to me, John, is Sonali Basak mentioned, you go back to 2019 for a pre-pandemic compare. If you take 2 years of their estimated GDP growth, you end up with 11.5% growth 24 months, which is 5.75% per year. Run rate in America is in the vicinity of 2% to 3%.
Well, let's look at the forecast in the release this morning, Tom. GDP growth in 21 expected at 6.8% in the US. US GDP growth in 22, 4.7%. So you're looking at 6.8% this year, 4.7% next year. And Stephen Biggar asked you the question. They're great GDP figures. Is that something that some of these banks can actually leverage? Because so far it hasn't translated into the loan growth that the banks of JP Morgan, investors in those names, were hoping for. Do you start to see that happen in Q4 and beyond?
Oh, I think it's a second half, help for the banks. Loan growth has started to resume at this point. I mean, that's going to be the most likely beneficiary for banks, is to get the loan balances to expand a little bit, where they've just been sort of held back. And we think there's a number of reasons for that. Confidence previously had not been where it needed to be, had tons of government stimulus in the form of enhanced unemployment benefits or, the outright checks to individuals. So Americans were flush with cash. They didn't need to borrow. But that wears off, the enhanced unemployment benefits in September. The stimulus checks are gone now. So I think we've seen some improvement in credit card lending. We've seen some improvement in auto lending, home equity as well. So I think they do begin to benefit in the back half from a bit stronger loan growth environment. Of course, yields have been a headwind here with the 10-year pulling back as it has. We think that's more technical and short term, and we'll get a little bit steeper yield curve as the balance of the years goes by. So I think the lending business outlook is a bit improved here than it was even a quarter ago.
Well, Stephen, let's go there. I often ask the question when I see a data point in earnings release, what does it change? Is there anything in these releases this morning that will change anything for a bank bull or a bank bear for that matter? Do we resolve anything with this week's earnings?
Well, it's a great question. It's not a single quarter does not a terrific bank make or a terrific, industry or a rebound. So I think we've had such a great rebound in financial stocks generally that, there could be a pause here as we kind of get an evaluation moving into the second half. Of course, the comments on the quarterly calls here are going to be pretty important, particularly as it comes again to loan growth. In my view, the case for bank stocks is really fourfold, that we do get that loan growth resurgence, that we have a bit steeper yield curve, that these, the credit quality remains stellar, not to the point of having massive reserve releases as we're now seeing from, we saw at least from JP Morgan. And then the much better capital returns, which are, demonstrated after a moratorium last year due to the pandemic, we're seeing some nice return of capital now. So I think there is, it could be a pause here as we look out in the second half and into next year. But look, I think everybody is expecting rates to move a bit higher. That's going to be beneficial for banks.
If we get that
rebound in loan growth, that's going to be critical as well.
And a lot of people seem to believe that there will be that growth, that rebound in loan growth. And yet we're still seeing deposits grow so much. We're not seeing consumers spend that incredible amount of dry powder that people are expecting them to spend. Isn't that concerning? Loan growth will pick up, but when matters? And if it doesn't pick up until next year, won't that be a bit of a bear case?
Well, or a pause case, as I mentioned, I think. I don't think it's a reason to sell banks when you have sort of this flattish loan growth environment. So it is, as you said, a little troubling that consumers do continue to save at the rates that they have, and banks are flush with deposits. That's a double-edged sword. Obviously, it's a great funding source. But funding is not the problem for banks right now. It's trying to get more borrowers out there, and I think that's going to have to come with an improving economy. I don't think you can grow the economy at the extent that we're expecting without some benefit from that return of loan growth.
Hey, Stephen, got to leave it there. Stephen Bigger, Argus Financial Institutions Research Director. Let's bring in Hugh Johnston, PepsiCo Vice Chairman and CFO. Hugh, great morning to have you on. An hour ago, we had a really hot CPI print in America. A lot of that is traced back to the reopening theme that we can get into in just a moment. But from your perspective as a company leader, a corporate leader in America and beyond, how do you navigate this increase in prices we're experiencing stateside over the last few months?
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning and nice to be with you all. Obviously, our company is performing very well right now, and a part of that is navigating some of the challenges from a cost perspective. The biggest thing we can do in order to manage that, candidly, is we invest in our brands and we invest in innovation. And by virtue of doing those things, we create products that consumers are willing to pay more for, and that allows us to take price increases that help us offset that inflation. So it's something that obviously all big companies are dealing with right now, and frankly, I think we're very well positioned to deal with it.
It's interesting when I have policymakers on the show, Hugh, when I have central bankers, Federal Reserve officials, they take this line that a lot of this is transitory. The bond investors do the same thing. When I talk to corporate leaders, I sense something a little bit different. How much daylight do you sense is between you and the policymakers making the calls down in Washington?
Well, we're always a little bit conservative on this front, right? So I'm not going to assume it's going to be transitory. I'm going to assume it's probably going to be around for a little while. And then we'll build our plans around that. If we happen to get surprised with inflation lowering itself more quickly, that's great. We'll adjust to that. But right now, I'm assuming it's going to be with us through the better part of next year.
We've heard some talk about sharpening cost management initiatives, Hugh. Does that mean cost cuts, or can you pass on a lot of this to the end consumer?
It's going to be both. I mean, as a company, we have a history of driving costs down. We announced this morning we were extending our productivity program through 2026 at north of $1 billion a year. And we've been taking out $1 billion a year plus since 2012. So we're always looking to run the company as efficiently as we possibly can because we don't want to waste dollars in any direction. That said, when input costs increase, we're also going to take some pricing. We do it every year. And we'll do it again as we get to the fall of this year.
Hugh, my colleague Kelly Lyons went through the revenue mix of the company at the moment, where you're seeing growth and where we're seeing a bit of contraction as well. As we see the increased mobility in a place like North America here in the United States, how is that increased mobility translating into the change in the revenue mix over at PepsiCo, Hugh?
Yeah, it clearly is moving more towards what we refer to as the out-of-home channel. So whether it's the food service, the restaurants and the like, and also convenience stores. Mobility clearly drives those channels. At the same time, what we refer to as the take-home channels are actually still growing as well. So we're seeing good benefit across the board. The reason for that primarily is we made a decision last year that despite the pandemic, we were going to continue to invest in growth capacity. We were going to continue to invest in our brands. And as a result, now as consumers have come back, we're there ready to capture that business, and we're gaining market share as a result.
You and I talked about how sticky some of this consumer behavior might be shortly after the pandemic and the lockdown when reopened, Hugh. Are you finding out it is sticky? Are you finding out consumers are snapping back to old themes, old habits?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, in all candor. It's not an either-or type of thing. Clearly, as mobility comes back, they're back in the habits of sort of balancing out healthier eating and then the occasional treat or indulgence. The one thing that seems to be sticking a bit more is breakfast at home. That's a trend that I think people had sort of forgotten about breakfast at home pre-pandemic. They rediscovered it, and they discovered they liked it. So I think as we move to these more hybrid working models, breakfast at home will remain elevated. Obviously, our Quaker business was down in the second quarter, but on a two-year basis, it's up about 9%. I expect us to maintain some level of elevated performance versus where we were 2 years ago.
Hugh, just before I let you go, just one final question, if I may. I always enjoy having you on the program because we get to go away from some of the core themes of the morning just for a minute or so. Let's do that right now. In the last week, the White House came out with an executive order on promoting competition in the American economy. And one of the themes, a couple of the themes that came out of that was this idea that consolidation is bad because it holds down wages and it leads to an increase in prices. I just wonder for your firm specifically what your message would be for the administration after they put that out.
Well, obviously there was a lot in that executive order, and most of it I don't think has a substantial impact on us. The thing we're obviously always concerned about is having a level playing field and enhancing competitiveness. So to the degree that things do those two outcomes, we're happy with it. To the degree that it reduces the level of competitiveness, obviously that's something we'd be less happy with.
That was the diplomatic response I kind of expected. Hugh, it's good to catch up. Thanks for making some time for us on a busy morning. Hugh Johnston there, the PepsiCo Vice Chairman and CFO.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.